Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Bahar Bahukotai. This week, Mish Hammer Kassoy discusses Bahar Bahukotai. Mish Hammer Kassoy is a member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Director of Recruitment. And now, Mish Hammer Kassoy.
Thank you, Larry. This week's Parsha is Bahar Bahukotai. And the Parsha sets forth a great economic vision of justice. And the vision this week is national as opposed to individual. It's not what each individual, the law that each individual needs to perform in order to get things right, but rather what we as a society need to do if we want to be a just society. And that, the opening of the Parsha is the rules of the sabbatical year, what we call Shemitah, and the laws of the Jubilee year, the Yovel. And these laws are enumerated not only here in Vayikra Kaf Hei, in the 25th chapter of Leviticus, but also in Exodus 23 and in Deuteronomy Devarim 15. The famous term Shemitah is really only found in the other two passages, whereas here the emphasis is that it's Ashnat Shabbaton. Shabbat Shabbaton Yel Aretz, Shabbat Lashem. It's a taking of a break, a rest for the land, which includes two things. One, that we're not allowed to work the land, which means that the major forms of planting, harvesting, pruning, all of those things are prohibited. The rabbis expanded that to include a lot of other forms of working the land, improving the land in any way. And then thing two, that we don't own the land. The land is for us for eating. For everyone, it says Shabbat Shabbaton Yeh La'aretz Shabbat La'Hashem Sadcha Lo Tizra V'Karmecha Lo Tismor. You cannot. That's what I just said. You shouldn't plant the field, nor should you prune your vineyard. Et Safich Tzircha Lo Tiktzor Et Inve Nezirecha Lo Tiktzor Shalnat Shabbaton Yeh La'aretz V'Haitah Shabbat. Vahaita Shabbat Ha'aretz Lechem Le'ochla, Lecha Ulavdecha, La'amatecha, Ulischircha, Ulitoshavcha, Hagarim Imach. That it's going to be a year of rest for the land, and the Sabbath product of the land shall be food for you and for your servant and for your maid and for your hired servant and for the stranger that sojourns with you and for your cattle and for the beast of your land. It shall be all its food, its increase, be food. Everything that the land brings forward should be food for you. And that, the Rashi understands, is that you don't own the land. The land is lo la'achila, lo la'hana'a asartim, ela shelo tinhog behem kebal habayit. That you should not treat the land as though it belongs to you specifically. You should eat it, but you shouldn't treat it as though it's yours. Ela hakol yu shavimba. The land belongs to everybody. Everyone is equal with respect to the law. You and your workers and all of the strangers on the land. Therefore the produce of the land has to be open for everybody. Hefker, ownerless, available to everyone. You're not allowed to put it in your storage bins. You have to leave it out there for everyone to get it. Everybody's allowed to eat it. It's not just that the poor people can eat it. Everyone can eat it, but everyone has to eat it as equals. And this is the thing that Rashi emphasizes very much, which emerges from the verse, but Rashi emphasizes that the land is... The food is available for eating, but that it doesn't belong to you. It belongs to everyone equally. So those are the two major components that are mentioned in Leviticus, that the land is, one, can't be worked, and two, that it is ownerless, that it belongs to everyone equally. Everyone has an equal chance, you and the animals and everyone in between owns the land equally. There's a third component of Shnat Shemitah, of the sabbatical year, which is only in Deuteronomy, which is the release of debts, that every 7 years the land whoever owes money should be released from their debts, and that whoever's dunning should not ask him to get his money back. This further increases this tremendous egalitarian vision that the land belongs to everyone, that everything belongs to everyone, that we're all on equal footing we're all on the same equal footing economically. The Jubilee year, the Shnat Yovel, takes that even a step further. There'll be seven, the Torah explains that there should be seven cycles of sabbatical years, seven times seven, and then on the 50th year, there'll be a second sabbatical year. And that sabbatical year, the second year, the Yovel year, will be the same as Shnat Shabbaton, as the Shemitah year, but it will include another two components, the release of slaves and the return to the land. V'avarta shofar tru'ah b'chodesh ha-shvi, b'asor l'chodesh b'yom ha-kippurim, t'aviru shofar b'kol artzechem. Then you shall call the shofar to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement shall you sound the shofar through all of your land. V'kidashtem et shnat ha-chamishim shana ukratem dror ba'aretz l'chol yoshveha. Yovel hi tiyeh lechem v'shavtem ish al elech huzato ish al mishpachto tashuvu. And you shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty through all the land to all its inhabitants. And it shall be a jubilee for you, and you shall return every man to his possession, and you shall return every man to his family. This is a vision of distributive justice, l'chol yoshveha. If it isn't for you, l'chol yoshveha, says the Gemara in Erechin, if it isn't for everyone, then it's for no one. Everybody has to be included. Egalitarianism in its full form, both the rich and the poor are equal. Everyone goes back to their original, as the land was distributed in the years that Yoshua conquered the land, and the land was divided, all of the 12 tribes, each family got a portion of the land. We go back to that original distribution of the land, everyone to their ancestral inheritance, everybody has a portion of the land. Similarly, every slave is released, everyone basically presses restart and comes back to their original situation of grand human dignity and freedom. Dror ba'aretz. It is freedom for the land. We are slaves only to God. We all have land. We are inalienably connected to our ancestral heritage. We have, each of us, a small piece of the land of Israel. We are nobility. We have dror l'chol yoshvecha. That is a vision of distributive justice. But what's interesting to me is that at the same time, there's a vision of distributive justice that all of us, each of us, are equally wealthy, equally landowners. There's also a vision of retributive justice. What happens during the other 6 years and the other 49 years? In those years, it's clear from here that there is a free market, right? There will be during the 6 years, you shall plant your land and prune your vineyards, and you should gather in its produce. That means to say we all start off equal, but we then work hard, The market economy is lauded. Everybody, private property is being respected. It's expected that you should go out and work your land and try to make money. And it's also clear that while this is valuable, and that along the way it's going to inevitably result in inequality. It's going to be that some of us are going to do better and some of us are going to do worse. Those of us who do better are going to be fortunate to be the ones that have to, that loan money to others, that purchase slaves over the course of time, that purchase land from other people, and that all of that seems to be appreciated as something that's respected and something that you should be able to do. Work should be rewarded and is the best way to create a productive society. It's fair to produce for yourself so that what we imagine is, on the one hand, a moment of distributive justice. Everybody starts off on an equal footing. Everyone has a portion of the land. Each of us, nobody is in debt. Everyone is equal. The land belongs to everyone or to nobody. But then there's also an opportunity to move from there. There is a moment of equal opportunity. And there will not be from this, it's clear, equal outcomes. Everyone has an opportunity to create their own outcome, to create their fortune and to build a fortune. And that fortune is being respected. So while we usually see equal opportunity and equal outcome as very different political philosophies that are in tension with each other, either you're in favor of everyone being equal or you're in favor of everyone being able to go out there and have a free market and do whatever they want, the Torah tries to hold both of these values in balance with each other. You should work and you should be rewarded. You should succeed and get ahead. But we also need, says the Torah in this week's Parsha, we need to press reset occasionally. We can't assume that when everyone has equal opportunity, that everyone will be able to succeed. It's clear in this vision that the Torah sets out, even in this utopian vision, that even in a utopian world, there'll be winners and losers. Some people will succeed in the free market. There'll be people who do well and acquire great fortunes, and there will be some people who don't. And in this utopian vision, there will be a need to press reset from time to time, that a just society needs to redress social gaps before they get out of hand. If we don't give everyone a chance to get out of their poverty, get out of debt every 7 years, or to return to landedness every 50 years, we can assume that what will be created is an upper class of elites and an underclass, a permanent underclass that has no chance of getting out from under poverty. So says the Torah, it's important. Absolutely, distributive justice is a value. We want everyone to have a chance. And in an ideal world, right, the ideal vision is that everybody has a portion in the Torah, in the land of Israel. Every family got an equal amount of the land of Israel. It belongs to everyone equally, and we want to go back to that world every 50 years, a world in which everyone shares everything and that nobody can lord over anyone else. However, we also want to create the ability to have what can be called retributive justice, that you get what's fair, that when you work hard, you can get rewards from it. It's possible to get ahead. So I hear the voice of free market folks everywhere suggesting that, oh, it's very nice to hold both of these values in tension, retributive justice and distributive justice at the same time. But if you press reset, a minor reset every 7 years and a full reset every 50 years, says the free market folks, that is going to come at a great cost. Why would I bother working and acquiring a massive estate only to have it dismantled at the end of 50 years? What is the point of working so hard if I can't keep everything that I've tried so hard to acquire? And I think, interestingly, that this perhaps introduces us to a third value of the Shemitah year, which is that is exactly the message, suggest some of the medieval commentators, that acquiring a massive estate is perhaps not such a fantastic idea. or not the ultimate goal in life, at the very least. The Akedat Yitzchak says that it's that exactly the point of the Shemitah year and the Yovel year is to understand that it's not just about acquiring more and more and more wealth, that wealth should be a means to an end, and that the more wealth you have doesn't necessarily increase the quality of your life. Says the Ibn Ezra, this is an opportunity to take a year of Torah learning, something that will be free to everybody and avail, and it will be, give you an opportunity to direct your thoughts to something beyond acquiring material wealth. When you take time from the drive for material wealth, you use that as an opportunity to see what you've, to see what have we really accomplished? What have we accomplished in the last 7 years? Sometimes it can be very disturbing to look back on what we've done in the last 7 years, in the last 50 years, to the land and to other things, to see that what we thought was acquisition and was growth and was progress has actually not been progress at all, and that we were better off pushing back from the table, taking a Shanat Shabbaton, taking a Shabbat for the land, and retaking stock, doing a little bit of contemplation, learning Torah, realigning our values. The Ibn Ezra suggests that the mitzvah of Hakel, which takes place at the end of the seventh year, at Sukkot time, this public Torah reading where everyone comes together is really a sort of closing ceremony for this sabbatical year of Torah learning where all of us have been realigning our values with the Torah. I myself personally have always wondered about the promise in this week's parsha, Ki tamru mano chal b'shna ha-shvi'it hen lo nizra v'lo na'asof etzvuata. What will we eat? I have always found this a very good question. What will we eat in the seventh year if we don't plant or harvest its produce? V'tziviti et birchati b'shnat ha-shishit v'asa tzvuata l'shalosh shanim. And says God, that he will command his blessing on the land in the sixth year, and the land will produce produce for 3 years. And I've always, as I've read this, thought, that's very nice. But can you really be sure that that's going to happen every year? What does it mean to have, can we really imagine a world in which every 3 years, every 6 years, or every 7 years, there would be a triple amount of produce? And it occurred to me as I was reading the Ibn Ezra and the Akedat Yitzchak that perhaps the answer here is not that necessarily the sixth year will really produce three times as much as we've had in the first, second, and third year, but rather that if we plan for it, if we realign our expectations, if we think appropriately, that maybe we can make do with what we have, and we can make do with less, and it will be enough. And we can see in that bracha, we can see bracha in whatever we're given. I think this is a deeply environmental message, but it's also a very spiritual message in terms of thinking about letting go of that constant need we have for more. Always needing more, whatever we have, it doesn't seem as though it's quite enough. We could use an additional computer, an additional tablet, a fancier car, a bigger garden. Perhaps if we would come back and say, wow, this is 3 years worth, and we could think of it as 3 years worth, we could actually not only manage in those 3 years, but experience those 3 years as a bracha, which is perhaps even better than the constant seeking after a bigger garden. So it seems to me that the message of Shemitah, at least what we've seen today, is three components to the value of Shemitah. First of all, the value of distributive justice, the idea that all of us should be equal in the land. We should not see the land. There should be a moment that the land is equal for everybody. Everybody has an equal portion. There's the message of Shemitah and Yovel. The land belongs to everybody equally, that it's an ideal, a moment of freedom to be able, for everyone to have an equal portion for all of us to share together. At the same time, there's also a value in retributive justice, an idea that if you work hard from what you've been given, which is a fair amount, that you'll be able to get ahead and move forwards and grow and thrive. And at the same time, that we need to step back from that growing and thriving and progressing every once in a while and make sure that that progress really is progress. Those three values seem to me a tremendous utopian vision, but far from our world. It seems to me that it would take a revolution to get there. And in truth, it has always been hard to keep. The Torah warns about the, already in this week's portion, as I just read to you, about knowing that there'll be those who think, this is too much for me, I can't possibly do it. And we see in the book of Yirmiyahu of Jeremiah that this was considered one of the reasons for the exile, this ascent, that people didn't manage to keep the Shemitah year, and that as a result, we were cast out of the land so that the land could reclaim its Sabbaths. As for the Jubilee, Shnat Yovel, there's actually no evidence that the Jews ever succeeded in making this take place. Well, Sefer Nehemiah talks about Shemitah, and it's clear that in the Second Temple period, Jews were given exemptions from paying taxes during the Shemitah, during the Shemitah year. And there's quite a lot of legislation in the Tanaitic period about certain leniencies in the Tanaitic period. When it comes to Shnat Yovel, to the Jubilee year, there's actually no signs in any historical book anywhere that it was ever really observed. And that makes me wonder, is it perhaps impossible in the real world to have something, to have a vision as wonderful, as tremendous, as revolutionary as the Jubilee year? And in fact, looking at the rabbinic text really does seem to confirm that suspicion, that perhaps the rabbis also felt that this was beyond doability, beyond feasibility, that at least with respect to the financial component, Hillel Hitkin Prozbil Mipnei Tikkun Olam, in Masechet Gittin, the Talmud tells us that, or the Mishnah, and then the Talmud, that Hillel saw that, felt that it was necessary to declare Prozbil for the sake of Tikkun Olam. Now, what is a Prozbil? A Prozbil is a halachic fiction in which one can give over their loan. So if someone owes you money in the sabbatical year, as the sabbatical year comes close, you can give that loan over to the Beit Din and authorize the Beit Din to collect that loan on your behalf at any time. And so since the Beit Din owns the loan, the Beit Din is not commanded to release the loan, and therefore it appears that that the loan is not actually released, and therefore it becomes possible to collect it after the sabbatical year. That's what the Prozbil is. This is a legal fiction that is still employed to this day. To sign a Prozbil agreement, which is to give over your loans to the Beit Din so that they can collect for you, even if you are ultimately the one that collects it as a shaliach, as an emissary of the court when the time comes. And it says the Gemara, why did he do this? It seems as though, says the Gemara, that Hillel looked around and saw that people were, when the seventh year came, where as it got closer and closer to the seventh year, people were unwilling to loan money. And even though the Torah says, prohibits us from refraining from loaning money to the poor, people would refuse just the same to make loans available to the poor people. And Hillel looked around and said, wow, it's more important that credit be available to the poor, shalotinol delit bifnei lovim, that the The door should not be locked in the face of borrowers. We can't have a credit crisis. Anticipating this decade's credit crisis, it's impossible that we should that people should need money and not be able to get it. That would be an economic tragedy, and therefore it's essential that credit be available. And the only way to make credit be available is to empower the rich to collect their loans after the sabbatical year. And this is called tikkun olam. This is for the benefit of the poor, says the Gemara. Because although had Hillel not made this decision, poor people wouldn't be able to get loans. Rich people would transgress the command not to be afraid of the sabbatical year. They would refuse to give loans, and this would be an even greater problem for the poor people than the fact that their loans are not released. This is supply-side economics. This is a gift. By making conditions better for the rich, the poor people certainly benefit indirectly. Says Hillel, this is tikkun olam. This is the betterment of the world. And when I teach this with my class, students feel torn. Most students perhaps see this is naturally good for the poor people. But at the same time, the Torah has given a privilege to the poor people, has said, release them of their debt so that they can get a fresh start every year. And this seems like this is so clearly such a wonderful opportunity for poor people to get out of debt and get a fresh start. And by taking away that opportunity for them, it becomes more and more difficult for them to get out of poverty. The rabbis make a decision to give up that opportunity for the sake of the availability of credit. And a similar halachic fiction was employed already in the late 19th century as the Jews began to return to the land with the Zionist movement. It was clear that the agricultural restrictions, which in truth Rabban Gamliel and Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel had already tried to make lenient as it was becoming difficult in the second century CE for Jews to stay settled on the land. As Jews came back and were trying to figure out how they could settle the land while only harvesting 6 years out of seven, it became clear that it was going to be very, very difficult for a struggling agricultural movement to succeed under those conditions. And already in the late 19th century, there was a movement for what became called the Hetzer Mechira. Rav Kook, in the beginning of the 20th century, became the most prominent advocate or rabbi who gave permission for this permission to sell the land every sabbatical year, the land would be sold to a Muslim, is still to this day sold to Muslims in a temporary sale for just that sabbatical year and the portion before and afterwards. So that the Jews could continue to work the land, but it wasn't their land, and that they wouldn't have violated the command to not to work the land in the seventh year. And while this became the dominant and accepted opinion and is still accepted very much to this day, there were always those who opposed it, most prominently the Chazon Ish, and there are still some who try to keep it. But what we see here is that the two major components of the sabbatical year, the Shabbat La'aretz, the release of the land, and the and Shabbat Shmitat Ksafim, the release of the money, both of them were, the rabbis found ways to circumvent that law and to allow the economy to continue as usual. And one can't help but ask, how did the rabbis call undermining this beautiful utopian vision, tikkun olam? And when I look at this Mishnah about Hillel tikkun prosbo mipnei tikkun olam, that Hillel invented this for the sake of tikkun olam, is part of a larger collection of Mishnayot in the fourth and fifth parak of Masechet Gittin, which they are very varied, but they're all They're united by the common denominator of Tikkun Olam, and many of these Mishnayot of common denominator also protect. They do help the underdog very much. They're designed to help the underdog. They protect women in need of divorce. They improve the plight of the slave. They command that we should. Someone who sells himself, for instance, and his children to non-Jews, we do not redeem him, but we redeem the son after the father's death for the sake of the Tikkun Olam. And I can see here that the idea is if we keep all the time redeeming someone who sells himself and his children to non-Jews, that we're basically encouraging an addiction. We're encouraging irresponsible economic, we're encouraging dependency. And we don't want to continue to feed the father's inappropriate behavior. We wait until the father is out of the picture, and then we redeem the innocent children. If we see that the father is going to keep selling his son into slavery, we don't help the children. We leave them suffering for the sake of Tikkun Olam. And I feel torn as I look at these Mishnayot. Because in some ways, I wish the rabbis would have said, slavery is a bad idea. No child will go unredeemed. No adult will go unredeemed. Let's put them all in employment training, rehabilitation programs, get everyone solidly on their feet, and make sure that no one falls through the cracks. But I understand that the rabbis felt that this was impossible. This is something that couldn't be done. And if we tried to do that, we wouldn't achieve anything at all. And that it was necessary sometimes to compromise with reality as it is, to work within an imperfect system and to make incremental changes. What would really be better for the children is if we help the children that we can help. What would really be better, it might be great to revolutionize. It might be necessary to revolutionize the entire system of the way marriage takes place and divorce takes place, which leaves women so very vulnerable because they have to get a divorce from their husband has to give them of his free will a divorce, and he's the only one in control. Perhaps there'd be better ways to break that system altogether. But we're not about to throw out the system. Say the rabbis, we're going to work within the system. We're not going to have a revolution. We're going to make a deal with the devil, but we're going to try to move in the right direction. We're going to try to help women as much as we can within the system. We're going to try to help children as much as we can within the system. We're going to try to help slaves and poor as much as we can within the system. And I look at these two visions, the vision that the rabbis call Tikkun Olam on the one hand, and the vision that the Torah lays out of Shemitah and Yovel, of the sabbatical year and the Yovel year, on the other hand. And I look at this and I say that I don't think that the rabbis really disagree with the Torah. In terms of what the ultimate goal is. The goal is there. But say the rabbis, if we insist on this utopian vision, on this revolutionary system, we won't go anywhere. We need to move forward incrementally. It's the only way we can actually go in the world. And what Shemitah and Yovel represent is an ideal, a vision, something to work towards, but not something that can be easily achieved. And so to summarize what we've learned so far, we've seen a utopian vision for state responsibility, one that reflects distributive justice, one that reflects the value of retributive justice, the ability to work and get ahead, one that also demands a realigning of values, of not putting materialism and productivity as the ultimate goal, but also of rest and of learning and of spiritual growth. We saw that vision was so radical that it could never really be actualized practically. The rabbis, therefore, even lent a hand in actually dismantling that system in some ways in the name of Tikkun Olam. But that's not because the rabbis are undermining the Torah vision, quite the opposite. They're trying to achieve it the only way they actually have the power to do so, which is incremental. And I think that perhaps this is a message for us. Perhaps we too can do the same. I don't think that Yair Lapid or the American Congress will be able to implement a Yovel or a Shemitah legislation. But I think that they can do, perhaps make incremental changes within our imperfect world that would move us closer to that utopian vision which the Torah imagines and we've just enumerated. We could have an educational system, a tax system, job opportunities, the streak that will shrink gaps between the richest and the poorest in our world, that create opportunities for sabbaticals and for reevaluating our lives, for stepping outside the rat race of material wealth. And we can remember that we want to have, that we, if we want really to have a Shabbat La'aretz, it has to be L'chol Yoshvecha. It has to be for all of the inhabitants. If it doesn't, if there's no, if we don't provide opportunities for freedom for everyone, then we really don't have freedom for anyone. Our freedom is interdependent on the freedom of everyone else. And my hope is that we can work together to make that vision possible. Thank you very much, and Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Mish. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.